Up next on Black Book Talk, the guest is Kimberla Lawson-Roby, author of Changing Faces.
Hello and welcome to Black Book Talk. I'm Patricia Welch, Multnomah County Library.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman from Portland Public Schools.
And we have the pleasure of interviewing Kimberla Lawson-Roby today. I know that many of you are familiar with her works because you come into my branch and you just check them out. You can't find these books on the shelf. So we're happy that you're here with us this morning. Hello.
Hello. It's wonderful to be talking with you.
Yes, and we both have in hand our copies of Changing Faces, your latest book, and we certainly want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. Maybe mention one or two of your other titles. And we also just want to raise... We want to raise the question of the popularity of African-American popular literature, whatever you think about it. There's certainly been some controversy stemmed by an article by Nick Childs, but we'll get to that a little bit later.
Okay.
First off, introduce our listeners to the main characters in Changing Faces.
Okay, well, the main characters are Whitney, Taylor, and Charisse. These women are best friends, have been since childhood, and they each have three different issues. Whitney is dealing with being 100 pounds overweight and, of course, struggling with this idea of trying to lose it and, of course, dealing with self-esteem issues. And then Taylor is a successful attorney, graduate from Yale Law School, but at the same time is ignoring symptoms of a female illness, sort of refusing to do something about it because she's afraid of what she might learn, and, of course, is dating a man who really has or sees no reason to get married to her. And then Charisse is the third friend who sort of judges the other two and pretends to be this holier-than-thou Christian, but is pretty much the most conniving woman that you might ever meet.
Oh, Charisse has issues. Writ large. Being Charisse's friend can be a challenge.
She does.
Where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, with the overweight aspect of it, I really started thinking about the fact that whether women, and I shouldn't even just say women, but people in general, whether you're trying to lose 10 pounds or 100 pounds, that struggle is still the same. And I really, over the last couple of years, started paying attention to my own weight. I don't know what it's like to be 100 pounds overweight, the same as my character Whitney, but I know what it's like to gradually lose 45 pounds over the last 4 years. And, of course, now at 40, feeling better than I have in my entire adult life, and just thinking that it's important that people pay attention to their weight because of all the health problems that it tends to cause. With Taylor, I had a friend who was having excessive bleeding every month to the point of almost needing a blood transfusion and still refusing to do something about it. And so now what I've learned after doing research is that there are thousands and thousands of women throughout the country who are experiencing the same and ignoring this whole situation. And then with Charisse, unfortunately, I know many women like her, many men like her who, you know, are within the church, who can't miss a church service, but, you know, they may curse you out on the church parking lot if you give them that opportunity. So.
Also, each one of them is not flat. In addition to that issue, there's also something else. Like Charisse has the husband who doesn't stand up to her.
Right.
And the parent, the mother and sister issue. Mm-hmm. With Whitney.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Taylor with her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. And there seem to be, there are a lot of issues with trust. I mean, whether founded or not, two out of three of these, well, actually all three of them, acted from a place of really not trusting the men that they were dealing with.
Exactly.
And I could understand it in some ways, but I thought, you know, this lack of trust and this need to control is really destroying a lot of these women. And is this something also that you encountered in terms of women that you knew or people that you met?
Mm-hmm. It has, and I'm really, I guess, sort of fascinated by women who feel this need to control their husbands completely. You know, it's a matter of, you know, their own insecurities is what it really boils down to. And I always have felt that if you can't trust the one you're with, then you don't need to be with them in the first place. And so that's why I really wanted to bring that out with these particular women. Taylor, of course, is dating a man, and quite obviously if a man is with you and he says he loves you and he's been with you for 2 years, but you can't really get him to fully commit, well, once again, you really can't trust him either. And of course, Whitney has gone through all of the above, and she believes that men don't treat her in the right way because of her weight, but of course, there are other issues as well.
This is true. You know, I really like the educational aspect of the book. I think if I hadn't been, if I had known that I was going to interview you, I would have still felt the same way. It wouldn't have been as clear to me. But as I read it very closely, I thought, you know, this woman has a lot of really good information that women need to know about. I mean, there are a lot of young women, and a lot of your readers are quite young, well, relatively young, young adults. And they may not know what to expect when they go in the hospital, which is not usually something that I pick up light fiction for.
Right.
I thought that you were very clear about that. And then the explanation of why someone would invest in makeup brushes, which seems kind of trivial, but I thought, you know, I wonder about that. Why do people spend a lot of money on these things? But then, you know, as the woman said, well, it lasts and it did the job. I thought, you know, there are a lot of nuggets of information about a lot of things, mm-hmm. you know, of traveling, a lot of experiences that many people still haven't had.
Exactly.
And to be able to learn this in such an entertaining way was, to me, a very good thing. Right. But I want to talk about something else that you deal with and you mentioned in your other novels, and that's revealing some things that go on in the church. What has the response of the church community been to you? And you might want to tell our readers about at least one of your other
Okay. Well,
casting the first stone.
For any of the listeners that don't know, you're speaking of my three books that center on the Reverend Curtis Black.
Oh, yes.
This character that I created, he's a pastor who is consumed with money and power and lots of women, and, you know, sort of says he's been called by God to preach, but basically stands in the pulpit on Sunday and pretty much says, do as I say and not as I do, and, you know, nothing is beyond him. He's pretty much capable of doing anything. And when I first wrote Casting the First Stone, which came out in 2000, I really pretty much expected that I would sort of receive this backlash, and, you know, if it wouldn't come from pastors, maybe just from members of congregation saying, why are you putting the dirty laundry of the church out in the open? And that's not what happened. What happened totally surprised me. I had pastors' wives coming to book signing events thanking me for writing their stories. That's really how they saw it. And then having readers tell me the names of actual pastors and churches in their own cities who fell into that category. And so I think that people are just tired of being misled, and they're tired of some of the things that are going on within the church. And this certainly is not every church, and this doesn't, you know, say that this is every pastor, because there are some wonderful pastors in the country. But for those who are like my character that I created, it's time that they are exposed.
Okay, I thought you were going to say you had to leave town, that you had been living in one community.
No, I did expect that, but that's not what the response was. And so that just sort of tells you how people in general throughout the country are feeling about this particular topic.
When your book came out in 2000, my book club read it,
mm-hmm.
and we had a wonderful evening. We could identify.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also want to mention that recently there was an African-American read-in at a local library,
uh-huh.
and one of the readers
Her
read
library.
The first... Okay, I'm trying not to do a promotion.
She didn't want to say that.
I didn't want to say that, right. But one of our readers read the first chapter of Changing Faces.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, a lot of good authors, you know, a lot of good readers. But I got to tell you, people were swarming to this book.
Oh.
So, I mean, I think you have another winner here. But I do want to introduce something else. I want to talk about something else just briefly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at a copy of an article called, it's an op-ed piece that appeared in the New York Times on January 4th,
mm-hmm.
called Their Eyes were Reading Smut, written by Nick Childs, who is himself an author, along with his wife, of a popular literature. But he is telling about his surprise in going into a bookstore and, well, first his joy in going to the Black literature section and seeing so many great books, but then his disappointment at the fact that most of them were on, well, what he thought were prurient topics. He was shocked. Have you read this? Are you familiar
with it? Yes, I have. I've read it.
Okay, and did you have any, all the blogs are just full of, you know, call and response on this. Do you have any response to this, any feelings about it?
You know, I guess my whole opinion is that when it comes to writing, when it comes to fiction especially, and when it comes to Black literature, that, you know, I guess it's six one way and half a dozen another. You know, I'm very, very excited about the fact that there are so many choices, because once upon a time, and even specifically when I started writing my first book in 1995, I could count the names you knew of African-American novelists on two hands. I always say there was 10 or less that I knew the names of. And of course, now you have at least that many coming out almost every single month of the year. And so I think that's a good thing. But I think what's happening when you read articles such as Nick is that these are people who are feeling as though they write at a certain level, and they're not selling as many copies as books that they've chosen to criticize for whatever. But for me, I just feel that a writer should focus on what they're writing on. They should stick with what they know. They should write from the heart and really not pay a whole lot of attention to what else is going on in the industry. And that's pretty much what I do. I write about very real issues. It's in a fictional format. And regardless of what's selling more than me, regardless of what my opinion is of what's out there, that's really, really not my concern. And so I just think that's, you know, where people tend to get caught up in wondering, why is someone selling more books than me? You know, it becomes more of a sour grapes issue, I think, more than anything else.
What's the premise of the article?
Well, it's really talking about the fact that, you know, there's urban fiction, there's street fiction, there's erotica, and almost feeling, I think Nick feels almost embarrassed at the fact that so many copies of those books are being sold and that the publishers have pretty much embraced it, and they're publishing them one after another, month after month, and so he's just a little bit upset about that.
And I do want to be very clear to our listeners that Kimberla Lawson Roby is not one of the people that Nick Childs was talking about in his article. That her reading is, you know, this is safe reading. This is the higher level. But, you know, African-American popular literature is selling. It's selling. People are borrowing it in libraries. And there are various levels in the same way that there are various levels in any literature. And I think with some books, you can look at the cover and you can make your decision. But for some people, that's the choice that they want to make. And, you know, that, as you said, that is their decision. But, I mean, there's also there are a lot of really great writers like you, Benilda Little, Nick Childs, and his wife, Denene Miller, who are writing really great popular literature, and people are reading it. So, you know, you have to give the readers some credit.
And you do. And then I always say, it's like, if it's, you know, for me, and this was even before I became a writer, if it wasn't for me, then I just didn't pick it up and I didn't purchase it. And so I just think that's really the attitude you have to go with.
I'm just glad people are reading.
And I am too, as well.
Thank you. Well, tell us that you've been writing for a while. I guess this will probably be our last question, but tell us about your path as a writer, how you got started, you know, what you'd say to other people who are interested in writing.
Well, my story is a little bit different in that I come from this background in marketing and finance. My degree is in business administration, and so at age 30 in 1995, I decided that corporate America wasn't for me and, you know, wanted to do something that felt more natural to me and something that I would be happy with doing every single day, and that ended up being writing. And so I wrote this book every evening, every weekend, holidays for 7 months, and went forward with trying to get it published and received tons of rejection letters from both literary agents as well as editors at the major publishing houses. And so my mom kept saying I shouldn't give up because so many people were reading copies of the manuscript locally and they were saying they couldn't put it down, and she just believed that that meant something. And then it was my husband who said, your background is in business. Why can't you just start your own company and publish the book yourself? And that's what I ended up doing. And to our surprise, sold 10,000 copies in the first 6 months and did find an agent to sign me on. And she was able to secure me a contract for my second book. And you know, now that's 8 books ago, and the 9th one is coming out next year.
Well, we are looking for the next one, and hopefully you'll come out to Portland sometime soon. We would love to host a visit by you.
Well, that would be wonderful. I would actually love to do that, so I hope that we can connect afterward, because that's one of the cities that I have not been to yet. And now my focus, you know, after once you have so many books out, then you start to want to go to the places that you haven't been, so I would really, really hope to be able to do that.
Well, great. Well, look, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be with you.
Keep writing, because we love reading.
Well, thank you. I will.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
From health to housing, from crime to criminal justice, from every educational component, economic parity, African Americans continue to face devastating disparities on every level. However, the time has come for African Americans to shift the conversation from talking about a plan to taking action on a plan. This is basically part of the back cover of a book that I'd like to talk about entitled The Covenant, and with the introduction by Tavis Smiley. This week, during the last week of Black History Month, on cable television, they're going to be showing the 2006 State of the Black Union Conference, and it's set for Saturday the 23rd at Houston, Texas. Excuse me, Thursday, February 23rd. Amongst the people that are going to participate in it will be a weekend of 35 black professionals, including educators, ministers, policymakers, and business leaders. And they will convene in Houston for the 2006 State of the Black Union Conference, a day-long forum where panelists will offer practical advice for uplifting America's black communities. Well, this is O.B. Hill with Black Book Talk, and I'd like to mention just some of the highlights of the conference, which culminated in a book entitled The Covenant. It is a book that's published by Third World Press, and it's in black and other bookstores throughout the nation right now. In fact, the book came out in concert with the conference, the State of the Black Union. Let me see here. Looking at it, I'll just read a little bit. It says, the notion of democracy is familiar. It's still not a reality for the majority of African Americans. Many members of the black community are increasingly disenfranchised and alienated from the electoral and legislative process. It is crucial for our survival as a people to take back the right to vote for all citizens. With education, empowerment activities, and leadership training, we can still uplift all African Americans, young, old, male, female, felons, and free citizens. Well, in reading this book, it's almost like deja vu. It's almost like you're rereading something you've read many, many times over again. Although the authors of the book say that we should not try and reinvent the wheel, so to speak, but to reinforce some of the things that we've already been trying. So therefore, they go all the way back and take a historical analysis of what we've tried to undertake all the way from the Marcus Garvey movement. In fact, they talk about, in the book, A. Philip Randolph, Marcus Garvey, and other people who have up to Martin Luther King Jr. It's a real interesting read. It's sort of like a national plan. It deals with everything from education to wealth building. And it has some very specific plans for going about improving not only the education but the betterment of African American people in the United States as a whole. I recommend reading the book, although it does remind me of many books and plans that we've had before.
And, excuse me, I hope that everybody, this is Patricia Welch, and I'm back in the studio with OB. I think the voice sounds like another person because the flu has caught me today. But I hope those of you who didn't see the State of the Black Union on C-SPAN will, you know, try to go in and you can, I'm sure there's some kind of stream. I'm so uncomputer literate, but that there's a way that you can go in and see it if you were not able to see it live. I always find this the event itself so inspirational, so I'm happy that they have a book that kind of gathers the thinking and the ideas that have come out of it. And it's just really a good reminder of how at least once a year some of the finest minds in African America come together and share their thoughts for the year. I want to talk about something, one of the finest minds in Portland has shared with us. And that is a book called I Woke Up and Put My Crown On. And it's by Rochelle D. Hart, known to many of us here as Rodeezy. Rochelle has, she instituted this project of 76 voices in which she sent a message to about 25 friends and said that she wanted to talk, she wanted to hear from African-American women about their life experiences. And in less than a week, I think, I'm pretty sure it was less than a week, maybe not more than 24, 48 hours, she had more than 400 people who responded and wanted to be a part of this project. The book is really just the voices of African-American women, young, old, variety of socioeconomic groups, and they're just sharing their stories. This book has been so impressive that for the book, Rochelle received an award from the Rosa Parks Foundation. But besides that, also a lot of acclaim, a lot of attention and appreciation here. I know that Rochelle has been very active. She's very active in February, and I'm sure will continue to be active in March in being in the community talking about her book. If you have an opportunity to hear her, please go forward, and you should listen to KBOO because I know that the appearances will be mentioned here. What was interesting to me was why she chose to do this, and it's almost as if it was, as if the idea claimed her. She said, in Portland, Oregon, it was the start of 2001, and I was contemplating ideas for my next book. To spare myself from being considered as just a poet, as opposed to a poet and writer, and having already published 4 volumes of poetry, I wanted to go in a new direction. I'm not much into fiction. I've always been more content delving into real issues. So the idea to write a fictional novel never occurred to me, and this is coming from the introduction of her book. Okay, she said she had spent a lot of time thinking about how blessed she was. But often that, you know, too often, unless you're rich, famous, or scandalous, or all of these, you'll probably never make the headlines. The women captured in this book, though celebrities in their own way, are not particularly any of the above. She started the project to create a voice for people who otherwise would live in silence, and that basically was the purpose of the Project of 76. She had a contest, and there was a winner of a poetry contest. I think I just want to read this poem, and that'll give you a sense of the book. Sister Talk, the 76 Voices Poetry Contest winner, and the poet's name is Jamila Wade. I had a talk with my girlfriend the other day, one of those sister talks, you know, when the spirit just soaks up the sadness and the sweet laughter, and my friend was telling me about how it felt being a superwoman who sometimes screamed for the madness to stop and often cried herself to sleep, who, without the support of her spine or the rhythm of her hips sashaying, who sometimes only believed in herself when she was by herself, had time to search inside herself for strength. And so for a while, God and loneliness were her only companions. And in that telling it like it is tone, she was expressing how recently looking in a mirror and loving what she saw felt just as much a revolutionary act as it felt natural to accept her yielding flesh and to behold the beauty in those places where the curves continue, where the scars scream for their stories to be told, where she is mesmerized by the glowing roundness of her belly, which she said reminds her of the sun or sometimes a blue moon. And we talk about loving our mothers, loving men, and most importantly, loving ourselves. My sister was amazed by her revelations, and I was too, because of the sitting on the front steps late Friday, sun stroking brown legs ways, she was asserting how sometimes the heart has to give in, even known it's opening itself to abandonment, and how sometimes that kind of pain and powerlessness doesn't even matter because she still has her soul and her sanity. Still manipulate shadows. And so we talk sister talk, but mostly I listen, because this sister, this wonder of a woman, had walked through so many fires, had turned herself loose from the webs of more than a dozen liars, had stayed true, which according to her ain't so hard anyway if one believes in second comings and phoenixes that rise renewed. Our conversation went on with ease as she was recalling falling hard off a trapeze, wanting to forgive the steel fists that never transformed themselves into brown butterflies, deserving more than what others were willing to give, and finally, celebrating the end of savage talk. No more passive resistance, no more brutal conversations between flat palms and soft cheeks, no more of that giving without receiving anything in return. My sister friend was astonishing me, still does, with the power and the passion she puts in songs and surviving and remembering and reliving and sister talking with supernatural women like me. The poem is Sister Talk, written by Jamila Wade. It is included in the book I Woke Up and Put On My Crown, The Project of 76 Voices by Rochelle D. Hart. We're going to close this this section, or this episode, I guess, of Black Book Talk today, and we are doing it with a really sort of a heavy heart, because we have been informed that science fiction author Octavia Butler died after a fall on Friday, February 25th. The writer suffered from high blood pressure and heart trouble and could only take a few steps without stopping for breath. She was found outside her home in the North Seattle suburb of Lake Forest Park. Octavia Butler has given so much pleasure, so much information, and so much enlightenment to so many of us. And we want to honor her life and her work and pass on our sympathy to her family and friends for her death. Obi, is there anything that you'd like to share about this?
I share every word you said about Octavia Butler, a great science fiction writer, and she will be very, very sorely missed. We pray for her and her family. In all of our endeavors, we will try and live up to that type of legacy in writing. Very, very interesting person.
If you have not read anything by her, even if you say, I am not a science fiction literature reader, you need to introduce yourself to her or allow her to introduce herself to you through her words. This is March. It's Women's History Month. We hope that you'll participate in all the activities around town. We hope you'll read a lot of good books written by women. We hope that you'll remember that history is made every day. And we hope you'll join us again in April for Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch, What's Left of Her Voice, signing off for the day.
And O.B. Hill, y'all have a good read.
Bye-bye.
Determined by
It's 2 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. At 11 on Democracy Now!, the topics are secret deals intended to provoke war in Iraq, British soldiers refuse to fight in Iraq, and an interview with Christian peacemaker teams. At 10:30, it's stage and studio. Michelle Schroeder Fletcher hosts an interview with members of Oregon Children's Theater's production of The Giver. And now the topic is Caught in the Crossfire, The Untold Story of Fallujah, a documentary film by Mark Manning.